And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Dr. Gregory Smith, who is the author of a recent book called Out of the Forest, The Story of a Recluse. And Gregory has an amazing story to tell us. So, Gregory Smith, welcome to the Dads on the Air.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Bill.
So, Gregory, in your book, Out of the Forest, you talk about your unhappy childhood and spending 10 years in a forest with no comforts. Does going over it now stir up bad memories for you?
No, not really, Bill. I think that time in the forest sort of provided me with time to reflect on what had happened and come to terms with what had happened, or begin to come to terms with what had happened. And then, later on, after I exited the forest and began my journey of education, I think that provided me with more depth of understanding and being able to come to terms with my childhood. And I'm quite okay with talking about it today. It just is.
Yes, well, you've changed in so many ways. I think at one stage you say you're one of those people who didn't like talking about your life and yourself, but now you've written a book and you're talking to us today.
Yeah, that's an interesting story behind that. I mean, I was approached to write the book. It was not my idea to write the book. Well, it took about 8 months for them to convince me why I should write a book, but they did eventually talk me into it. They said it may... Yeah, it's an interesting story, so I went with him on that.
Yes, it certainly is. It's a great story and it has to be told, so I'm very pleased you agreed with that. But when you emerged from living in the forest after those 10 years, you weighed 41 kilograms. I think I noted that you'd be too light to be a blood donor, but you must have had a very strong constitution to survive for 10 years just living off what you could scrounge in the forest.
Well, the human body is an amazing organism. I think the important thing to understand there, Bill, is that it was only the last couple of years that I really started to get sick. In the beginning, I was, physically I was pretty fit. I was pretty healthy. It was only, when I made a critical decision to become a vegetarian without actually understanding the basics of nutrition, that I started to deteriorate significantly in my physical well-being.
We might just go back to your life before you went into the forest, and your memories of life at home with your parents, Bruce and Beryl, were bad enough, but then at age 10, you were deceived by your mother, really, and found yourself somewhere worse, at St. Patrick's Orphanage, Armidale. So for 16 months, you were under the care of Sister Winifred. Perhaps you could just tell us a little about the experience in the orphanage.
Yeah, that wasn't... I didn't have the capacity to understand bad or good or, it was just... I didn't like what was happening to me at home. And it was a whole new world when I entered the orphanage. And I guess that really became apparent that very first day. In the home situation, I'd always had my siblings, we had each other. So, we could comfort each other, talk to each other and things like that.
You had those four sisters, didn't you? Maybe it might have been more helpful if you'd had a brother, but anyway, you can't order these things up, I suppose.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
but that day that I went into the... we went to the orphanage, I was forced to go to the left and my sisters went to the right, and that became a moment, a very, very sort of significant moment in my life where all of a sudden I didn't have my siblings as well. I actually protested against that, and that's when I first, felt the first taste of a nun's wrath, really. I was told to shut up and be a good boy and get over it, and I was not to have any real contact, meaningful contact with my sisters again for that whole period we were in the institution. institution.
It almost sounds like the Nazi division of workers and non-workers, doesn't it? It sounds it must have been horrific. It was violent as well. I mean, you had a violent time in your home life, and then you finished up in the orphanage, where it was again, and perhaps it was even more violent.
Yeah, I can reflect on that today and understand that, but at the time, it was just a continuation of inflicted pain, and I think by that stage, I'd become quite cautious of grown-ups. I certainly didn't trust them. I had my own mind, and one of the dangerous things that I tended to do was challenge them as well. So they didn't like that.
And it wasn't only the physical violence. I mean, clearly, as demonstrated by your later life, you've got intellectual ability, but they found ways of getting into your psyche as well.
Yeah, there's nothing like being stuck in a dark closet for a couple of days to sort of make you think about stuff and sort of turn your mind in on itself, that's for sure. And I mean, there are things you never walk away from. They're with you forever after that. Yeah, but again, it's about how you manage those in later life.
And one thing that seemed to have had a lasting effect on you was a report from a psychologist who described you as being at the lower level of dull. And when you're branded as with that, and you're branded with being a sociopath, you tend to sort of live up to what you're being told, I suppose.
Yeah, well, they were interesting times. I mean, it was the state. New South Wales state psychiatrist that gave me the label sociopath, and as you correctly point out, a psychologist identified me as at the lower edge of dull. But, I mean, they just did not understand. They had no... To contextualise that, this was in the 1970s. There had not been a lot of research done around trauma and post-traumatic stress and those sort of things at that time. So these people were struggling to find the appropriate labels to hang on me, and they put their hand in the closet of labels and pulled out those ones and stuck on me. And in some ways, it makes sense why they would find those labels, because I was certainly, as a young boy, I was certainly disengaged. I didn't trust people. I didn't trust the systems around me, so I didn't want to engage. And so they saw me as non-engaging, and sociopaths fitted the label.
And there was still worse to come. You finished up becoming a ward of the state, and you spent time in other institutions where you picked up some bad habits along the way, and I think you finally emerged into the workforce at about the age of 19.
That's correct, yes.
And
By the age of 19... most of us are prepared, we're a little bit excited about our futures, we're just wanting to get in and live life. Well, I found myself with no idea of what I was supposed to do. I had no idea. The things that I'd learned in the institutions, I'd learned how to march, I'd learned how to, bust rocks, dig holes, scrub floors, but I never learned how to find a job. I never learned how to pay a bill. I never learned how to find somewhere to live. And I certainly didn't learn how to have a conversation, because I was one of those kids in the institutions that spent a lot of time unprivileged. And one of the things I learnt in the institutions was that it's a privilege to be able to talk to another human being, because I spent a lot of time not allowed to talk to others. And that tends to retard your capacity to develop the idea of a conversation.
And things were so bad, it sounds strange to most people to hear this, but you were able to find out from the FOI records that you actually had a marriage that you don't remember.
That's true. Yeah. That's the long-term effects of drug and alcohol abuse, really, isn't it? I mean, I don't remember a lot of my life. And I mean, that was one of my objections to writing a book in the first instance. There are areas of my life I don't have good recollection of. And one of the interesting things that's came out since the release of the book is, people have come forward and sort of spoken to me and said, oh, do you remember this and this? And gradually I'm putting more and more together. So for my, for my personal benefit, the book's actually healing. Well, not healing is probably not the right word, but it's informing me more about my life as well. I had one person who I had some dealings with when I would come out of the forest, and that person said to me, wow, that's a sanitized version of the events, isn't it?
Well, it doesn't seem too sanitized, but I'll take your word for it. But this was just before you went into the forest. You were about 35 years old. Gregory, you might just take a short break now, and I thought we might listen to a little bit of a song you've always liked. It's by Queen, and it's called Bohemian Rhapsody.
Thanks, Bill.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy, I need no sympathy. Because I'm easy come, easy go, little high, little low. Any way the wind blows doesn't really matter.
Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, a favourite of our guest today, Dr. Gregory Smith, who is the author of a new book called Out of the Forest, The True Story of a Recluse. Gregory, we were just at the stage where you're about to go into the forest, and I think you were about 35 years old at this stage. Why would you go into a forest with, with no comforts at all. You didn't take your bed in there. You didn't take your cooker. You didn't take anything.
Well, yeah, I took my crooked mind in there, that's for sure. But look, I guess the simple reality, Bill, is I didn't wake up that morning and decide I was going to go and live in a rainforest. You know, the simple truth is that was the end of the road for me. That's where I ended up. And it was just another long walk on another road, and you know, I got to a T intersection, you know, and the sign said Pacific Highway that way, and there was a dirt road that way. Well, I knew what was on the Pacific Highway, and I'd been walking that for years. Mm. You know, but I didn't know what was down that dirt road. And curiosity got the better of me, and I ventured down that dirt road, and there was a rainforest at the end of it. Yeah, it was. I found, you know, it took me a while to work out it was a rainforest, but I did because of the, and it was just a beautiful place. You know, somewhere I really felt comfortable.
Probably saw a rainbow, and it is a nice part of the world up, and it was up near Mullumbimby. About, I think you described a 2-day walk from Mullumbimby.
Yeah.
What was your sleeping arrangement there?
In the beginning, it was underneath the dry as a bone. And actually, the dry as a bone served me well. That was my key shelter for quite some time. Yeah, you know, I was too numb. I wasn't smart enough to think I needed somewhere to live. You know, and I was just grateful to have peace. And so I would just use the dry fire and the dry as a bone to keep myself warm and protected.
And you had plenty of time to think about life and think about yourself, but I don't think you did too much planning while you were in the forest, did you?
No, I didn't. It was, you know, that's where I learned the advantages of living in the now. You know, it was quite spontaneous. Everything was spontaneous. You know, I'd wake up in the morning and I hadn't, you know, you see there's not much wood for the fire, so I'd have to go and get firewood. And then was like, well, yeah, I need new ferns or new foliage for the bed, so I'd go and get that. And, a lot of it was just spontaneity. It was just take it as it comes, enjoy the moment.
And you did come to town sometimes. In fact, you describe your interaction with a woman there. In fact, there seem to have been women turning up at various points of your life that have been an enormous help to you.
That's true, Bill. Yeah, well, it's interesting because there were probably men there as well. It's just that I'd pick a fight with the men.
Yeah.
I tended not to or inclined to be as physically violent towards the women. So I guess I allowed the women or more communication with the women. But I mean, I was more likely to have a full-on fight with a bloke.
Well, part of the problem seemed to be this vicious circle where if someone was kind to you, you sort of read it the wrong way and would then your modus operandi was really to take flight and disappear again, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I understand what that was about. That was about, you know, I didn't like me. You know, so if I didn't like me and if you got to know me, you weren't going to like me and I didn't want you not to like me. So it was better to, you know, not engage in that type of a relationship in the first instance.
So after living this life, getting by for 10 years, and your health finally had deteriorated, as you said, you made that big decision to become a vegetarian, which is making it even harder for yourself when you're living off what you can find in the forest. But what was the crucial thing that actually got you out of the forest?
Yeah, that was an argument I had with an alien. towards the end, yeah, it was getting a little bit crowded in the forest. I mean, yeah, my ancestors started turning up some time prior, and I was sitting there around the fire. I was sitting at the fire there one night, and then all these people started turning up. They were actually quite concerned about my well-being, and you know, they were saying, you know, you're looking quite sick. You know, you probably need to move out of the forest now. You've been here long enough, and all this sort of thing, and I could cope with that. I mean, they weren't going to get the better of me. I was happy where I was. Nobody was going to change that. But then one day these aliens turned up, and I mean, their logic was so simple. I couldn't argue with it, you know. And the logic was, look, yeah, okay, you want to die in the forest? That's all good. You know, we accept that you want to die. Everybody has the right to die. But think about this. You die in the forest, nobody finds your body. You've got, you know, you've got, still got sisters out there. You've got a daughter out there. They'll have no closure. So in reality, you're causing them more pain and grief. Whereas, you know, if you go back into society, you know, you can just as easily die there. Yeah, nobody's going to deny you that opportunity. But, you know, they'll find your body and at least your family, sisters and your daughter will have closure. I couldn't argue with that. I didn't want to hurt anyone. You know, I really didn't want to hurt, you know, cause my family any grief. So I made that that tough decision. You know, that, that, well, as you point out, you know, I was pretty sick. I was 41 kilos. Yeah, I could just as easy go into society and die. You know, I was a miserable soul at the time anyway, so I cleaned up my little area. I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to damage the environment. I just cleaned all that up and then went back into society.
And you, yes, you, that simple statement, you went back into society, but you did get the benefit of some social services, but it must have been an enormous turning the Titanic around to be living in the forest with nothing to all of a sudden be aspiring to getting that good education and becoming a useful member of society again.
Yeah, well, I guess you know, it's quite challenging to provide any real depth of insight into what happened at that time. I do talk about that in the book. You know, I talk about that quite in depth in the book. But and that come down to an epiphany, you know, making a decision not to be who I was at that time, and then realizing that, you know, a really important realization that I'd actually learned to live in a forest. So if I could learn to live in a forest, why can't I learn to live in society? You know, yeah. The key word there is learn.
Yes, well, it's often called a jungle, and when you came out into that jungle, you were surprised with things like mobile phones and computers, which you you'd yeah. never seen before.
Well, they didn't exist when I went into the forest, and I come out and there's, you know, I mean, there's all this new technology. It's amazing. Yeah, you know, it's like, and you know, I made the most of that technology to get to where I am today.
Yes, there were two sayings that you said were very useful, and I think they're probably useful for all of us, where one was be there at the end, and then the other one was to be just be the best person you can today. And I think that's of wider application, that very helpful to you.
Absolutely. And, I mean, they're still my key philosophies, my very basic philosophies today. Be there at, you know, I have three goals today. Only three goals. You know, I get out of bed in the morning, I get through the day without hurting anyone, including myself, and I get to bed at night. If I can do that, I'm doing okay. And the other one is, you know, just be the best person I can. That's all I can be.
Well, it's such a wonderful story. I mean, 8 years after you came out of the forest, you got your bachelor's degree, you're a doctor, you've got your doctorate in sociology, and you've reunited with your sisters, and I think you're working on a good relationship with your daughter. So it's an amazing end to this, well, amazing development in the story from where we started, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty okay with where I'm at today. I went and had a beautiful dinner at my daughter's home last night and had some fun with my grandkids. And, you know, to me, they're the ultimate moments. If you want to live in the moments, you know, they're the ones I would choose.
Yes, look, it's all made you the person you are today, and in that spirit, I've asked you if you'd like to pick a song for us. Could you tell us which song you picked and why you picked it?
Yeah, I picked a song by the Travelling Wilburys. It's Nobody's Child. The name of my thesis, my PhD thesis, is called Nobody's Children, and when I was asked to start doing my research in my honours on that, I heard this song, and it's reflective of my work today. It doesn't have to be that sad, but it's reflective of my work.
As I was slowly passing an orphan's home today, I stopped for just a little while to watch the children play. Alone standing, and when I asked him why, he turned with eyes that could not see, and he began to cry. I'm nobody's child. I'm nobody's child. Just like a flower, I'm growing wild. No mama's arms to hold me, no daddy's mine. Nobody wants me, I'm nobody's child. Places just like this, with rows and rows of children, babies in their cribs. They've long since stopped the crying, as no one ever hears, and no one's there to notice them or take away the fears. Nobody's child, nobody's child. Just like a flower, they're growing wild. Got no mommy's kisses and no daddy's smile. Nobody wants them.
That was Nobody's Child by the Travelling Wilburys, chosen for us today by our special guest, Dr. Gregory Smith. And it just remains for me now to thank our guest. Gregory, thank you very much for being on the program and sharing your extraordinary life with us.
My absolute pleasure, Bill, and it's been good. I've enjoyed the moment.
So we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you would like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.